My name's Jeremy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jeremy.
And they asked me if I was willing to go to any leagues. I said yes, so I couldn't tell my sponsor, you know. Well, I'm just decided not to go. I had a wonderful ride up, and speed limit 60 out there, and I don't know why they want to do 25. I didn't have any problem. I love this part of the state. It's beautiful up here, especially this time of the year, and with the snow and stuff, it was beautiful. I was just looking at all that. I wasn't paying attention to the road most of the time until it got dark. My sobriety date is September the 17th of 2000. My home group is the Socratic Study Group. It's in Portsmouth, Virginia. And as Billy was saying, I'm very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught from the very beginning to jump right in the middle and not stay on the outside. You know, we have our little chips. I don't know if y'all do them here, but little chips, they're rough around the outside, and they're pretty smooth in the middle. And they got AA in there, and it stays pretty smooth in there. And that's where I try to stay today, you know, through the 12 steps, service work, and the unity and the fellowship. And I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor, and so up. And I sponsor other guys, and they sponsor other guys. And I've taken the 12 steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that that's where the directions are. And, you know, that book helped a lot of people get sober in the beginning before anything else was written. And it worked for them, and it works for me just fine. My earliest recollection and memories were just not quite fitting in, just being different, you know, feeling empty on the inside, not quite measuring up to other people and stuff. And that was at, you know, an early age, probably, you know, 5 years old, 6 years old in kindergarten and stuff. And just felt really uneasy around other people. And my father left my mother when I was around 5 or 6. I was very young. And my brother and I would live with my mom. And she sent us to live with my dad and the woman that he was with. And I was 7 years old at that time. And she was young. She was in the military. She was in the Navy. She was alcoholic. My father worked 24 hours on, 24 hours off. So one night when he was working, she sat my brother and I down and gave us a beer. And I remember drinking that beer. It was just a little pony bottle, Miller High Life. And I just remember feeling okay and comfortable, you know, and feeling grown up. Because I knew, you know, I knew alcohol beer was for grown-ups. It wasn't for kids, you know. But she gave me that beer, and she proceeded to tell us some more stories and some other things. And I just felt comfortable with the conversation. And I remember when I got done with that beer, I asked her for another one. And she said no. I was pretty sad about that, but I didn't drink again. I went back to live with my mom and the man that she was with, who later became my stepfather, and I consider him my father today because he was the man that has been in my life and still in my life, and that stepped up, took the responsibility and raised me and loved me as his own son. And I have a lot of respect for him, a lot of admiration for him, and he is a great role model in my life today. And I say that today because of the 12 steps. You know, 6.5 years ago, I wouldn't have told you that. You know, I would have told you I couldn't stand him. He was mean. He was, you know, a jerk. There was some physical abuse growing up in the home. You know, I would have painted this picture of him as just being this terrible, awful, you know, abusive stepfather. And it's not what he was at all. So I went back to live with them. And over the next few years, I always hang out with, you know, kids that were a little bit older than me and just wanted to fit in. And I would go to this one guy's house when I was young, and his parents were alcoholics. They drank a lot, and they had some liquor there. And we would get into the liquor every once in a while and just take a shot, you know. And I'd take that shot of Smirnoff Vodka or Canadian Mist, and it would burn so bad, and it was disgusting. And it never did nothing for me, and it was horrible. And I didn't want to do it, but he did it, so I felt like I had to. Because if I didn't, then I felt weak, and I felt, you know, less than. And so that's why I did it. Never felt any effects off of it. When I was 12 years old, I got drunk for the first time. And during this time, you know, I always did very well in school, very smart, I mean, honor roll, straight A's and B's. And I was in the, I guess it was 7th grade. Yeah, 7th grade, 7th or 8th grade, I was 12, and me and a couple buddies went and got somebody to buy us a 12-pack. We went and sat in some woods, and we drank it, and I got drunk. And that was it. That was what I'd been looking for. Because I was with them guys, and I didn't feel any better than them, and I didn't feel any less than them. You know, I was equal. And You know, we used to ride skateboards a lot and stuff, and I was never really any good at that stuff, and they were pretty good. But after drinking those beers and getting the feeling and the effects of alcohol, you know, I was that good. And it just didn't matter that I wasn't as good as them. But I was okay with that. And I didn't start drinking immediately right away all the time after that, just, you know, here and there on the weekends after football games or whatever. But I always, when I drank, I always had to drink more than everybody else I was with, because I had something to prove. I had to prove to you that I was just as good, if not better. Because on the inside, I just felt worthless. I felt no good, of any use. There was no equality there. And just total disconnection from another human being. And I didn't know what was going on with me at the time. I couldn't explain it. And I didn't know if other people felt that way, but I know I was petrified and terrified to let anybody know how I was really feeling. So I kept that stuff bottled up, and I never said a word to anyone about that. By the time I was 16 probably, I was in high school, and 10th grade, I started skipping school a lot. My grades dropped dramatically. I went from an AB student to a DE student. I failed a couple classes. I never failed a class before, and I started failing classes in high school. And I was skipping school, and I would just start drinking, you know. I would go to the 7-Eleven in the morning, steal a bottle of Mad Dog, drink it, get drunk at the bus stop, go to school, pass out. I would have a bottle in my locker to drink on throughout the day, or saving for after school to stay after for some, you know, type of activity or something. I remember when I was in 8th grade, we had stole some Mad Dog, and we drank it after school. We stayed back for a wrestling match. And I got to see the first wrestling match, and I started to feel sick, so I went to the bathroom. And I went to the bathroom. I didn't get sick, but I did pass out. And I woke up, and I went back out into the gymnasium, and I was able to catch the last wrestling match. And, you know, and that was fun. It was funny, you know. There was nothing wrong with that. I didn't see anything wrong with that. You know, my buddies and friends were laughing, and it was just a good time. I didn't see any insanity in that at all. That was just normal. It was okay. But, you know, and I continued to drink like that. And, you know, and as I got a little older, I started looking up to guys. And, you know, and Bill Wilson talks about in his stories role models, being a stockbrokers and stuff, and the guys on Wall Street, you know, and he figured out the law wasn't for him, and he was, you know, wrapped up in that whirlwind on Wall Street and the success and the fast life. And I got wrapped up in the fast life, too, and my role models were, wrapped up in the fast life, but it was at the opposite end. You know, they weren't prominent businessmen. They were street pharmacists and, criminals and violent people and stuff. So those are the guys I aspired to be like, you know. They weren't going nowhere with their life. They weren't doing nothing, but they were my role models. And that's what I wanted to be, because that's what I thought a man was. You know, I never saw my stepfather. I never saw him cry. I never saw him show any emotion, like hurt feelings or anything like that. You know, what I did see was anger and from time to time a little bit of laughter. And other than that, he's just pretty mellow and pretty neutral. You know, I didn't know that that was peace or serenity, you know, that he just goes through life accepting life as it is and does the best that he can and tries not to get, you know, he's an emotional balance. And, you know, I didn't know that at the time. But so I thought, you know, a man didn't cry and a man was rough and tough and could stand up for himself, and I was scared to death on the inside. I didn't like to fight. I couldn't stand up for myself. And I felt weak, and I felt like a coward. And add a little alcohol into that mix, and I became, you know, the guys I aspired to be like. And I even took it a step farther, and I became a little worse than they did. You know, they knew when to stop, and I didn't. Somehow I managed to graduate high school. I'm not sure how that happened. I guess God was working in my life, you know, even back then. But, you know, I was involved in a relationship all through high school, and I was with this woman for about 4.5 years, but we had split up for a period. And it was during the end of my senior year and after graduation and stuff, and, you know, and there was no more school. I worked full time at a restaurant at night, but there was no more school. There was nothing to do during the day, so I could drink around the clock now. And that's what I started doing, and I drank for oblivion every single day. And, you know, I got back together with this girl, and we're out with some friends one night. I'd signed up to go to a vocational school, Howard Tech. I was going to take computer electronics or something like that. And, you know, I was battling in my head because I'm working in this restaurant and I enjoy what I'm doing. You know, I've progressed from, you know, started off as a dishwasher at the age of 16, and I'm, you know, I'm 18 now in high school, and I'm managing the kitchen, and, you know, in my head, it's like, I'm just going to stay here, you know, I'm just going to work in this restaurant, and they're planning on branching out and opening more, and, you know, I can make a career out of this, and I love what I was doing, and I was very good at what I did, and, but at the same time, I was like, well, I need to go back to school. My parents were hounding me, they wanted me to go to college or do something, and, so I signed up to go to this vocational school. And I went down and I went through, took a tour of the school and the classrooms and stuff, and I made an appointment to come back on a Monday morning to fill out the paperwork and sign up and enroll and get the financial aid and all that stuff. And that Sunday night prior to that, I was out with some friends. We went out, been drinking all day, went to a pool hall, we were shooting some pool, and it came time to leave, and one of the guys that was with us, we all had fake IDs, and he didn't have a fake ID, so they wouldn't serve him. So me and a buddy of mine, we agreed to order his drinks on our tab, and we were going to pay for him, and he was supposed to pay for the pool table, you know, when we left. Well, he left and didn't pay for the table, and my girlfriend and I were, you know, were there, and we were leaving after everybody else, and it was my girlfriend and I and another buddy of mine and his girlfriend. And as we're leaving, walking out, the manager of the place at the front asked me if I was ready to pay for the table. I told him no. I said, the guy just walked out and paid for it. He said, no, you're going to pay for it. And right there, when he said that, I felt threatened. And immediately something clicked inside my head. And my pride was way out there. I felt like he was attacking me. And I didn't like to feel that way. You know, I didn't like to feel... I didn't like to feel intimidated by anyone. I couldn't admit that I was intimidated by anyone. So he and I had some words, a verbal altercation that carried over outside in the parking lot. There was a group of people standing out in the parking lot already. They'd been inside drinking for some of the day, and one of those gentlemen started following me in my car and saying a few things and stuff, and I had a few words with him. I got in my car and I pulled out of my parking space, and I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to show them. You know, not to mess with me. And I'm going to show them I'm crazy and not somebody, you know, to be messed with. And I drove right at them, all of them. And there was about seven or eight of them out there. And they all moved except for the one guy. And he didn't move and I didn't stop. And I hit him. And for a brief moment, I blacked out. I don't remember hitting him. What I remember is seeing 2 feet at the top of my windshield go over top of my car. And when I saw that, I thought to myself, oh, my God, you know, not exactly those words, but... You know, you can get the picture. And I knew I was in trouble. I knew I'd screwed up big time. This was not like, you know, just getting in a street fight and hurting somebody that way. This was serious. And I kept going, and I was freaked out. I was scared. I went to my buddy's house. I tried to drink a beer. I couldn't even stomach a beer. And I sobered up instantly. Instantly sobered up. And I went home, woke my parents up, told them what happened. My dad and I went up to the 3rd Precinct police station up the street, and I turned myself in, and I was arrested, and I was taken to jail, and 2 days later, this happened on November 6th, November 8th was my parents' wedding anniversary, and November 8th was 2 days after I was in jail, and they took me back down in front of the magistrate, and they arrested me for first-degree murder, and because the guy had died in the hospital, you know, and I didn't even think about, you know, my parents' wedding anniversary or nothing. You know, I had to call home and, you know, let them know what's going on. And my dad had already known, and the cops had already came by and told my parents what were going on. So I'm 18, I'm in jail, I'm facing 20 to life, and, you know, scared to death, and I don't know what's next. And, you know, I didn't really believe. I believed in a God or a creator, but I didn't have any faith or any trust in any type of God. I didn't believe in any God that was personal to me. You know, some family members of mine belonged to a religion, and they were telling me who and what God is, and this is what you have to do in order to go to heaven, and blah, 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 blah. And I just couldn't buy it. I didn't believe it. You know, who's to say one religion is right and the other one's wrong? You know, who's to say you have to do this in order to be forgiven and go and, you know, go to heaven or whatever, you know. I just don't believe all that stuff. I didn't believe it then. I don't believe it today. So I just kind of turned my back on that, you know. But I prayed to whatever God that was out there, you know, for some help, you know. Get me out of this. It was an accident. I'm sorry. You know, I don't deserve this. And, you know, just a bunch of self-pity. Anyway, I spent a month in jail, and I got bonded out. And my dad got me a lawyer, spent a lot of money bonding me out and getting a lawyer. And the lawyer suggested that I not drink and I not drive. And I agreed. Those were great ideas, you know, while I was out getting ready to go to trial. And so about a week or so later, I decided it would be okay to drive my drunk friends around, you know, so they didn't get in any trouble like I was in. And so I started driving my drunk friends around, you know, and about a week or two later, I decided that it was okay for me to drink, too, because it wasn't going to happen again. This time's going to be different, you know. I wasn't facing 20 to life because of my drinking. It was because the guy made me angry, and the guy didn't move out of the way. Seven other people had the opportunity to move. He had the opportunity to. He chose not to. It wasn't my fault. So, and that's the way I thought, and I started drinking again. I started having some physical problems with drinking, vomiting, some blood and stuff, and I went to the doctor, and my doctor told me to probably cut back on my drinking or stop. And he gave me Antabuse, and I took the Antabuse, and I didn't drink. I did a lot of other things. I was never completely sober. And the whole time I didn't drink for that period until I got locked up and I went to prison. And it was a couple of months, I don't know, two, three. But I was also seeing a therapist at that time, and I was diagnosed with severe clinical depression. I was on antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication. I had really bad anxiety attacks. Felt like my chest was about to explode from the inside out, you know, heart racing and just full of fear. And, you know, and these medications didn't work for me, you know. I know there's a lot of opinions in Alcoholics Anonymous on medications, and, you know, and I've been on both sides of the fence, and today I don't have an opinion, you know, and that's a great place to be. It's whatever works for you. You know, if you want to take meds, if you think it's going to help, it's great. It's not my place to say, I'm not qualified to tell somebody whether they need medication or not. You know, I'm no spiritual guru to tell somebody that they will not have the same spiritual experience that I've had as a result of the 12 steps if they take medications. I sponsor a guy who's on medications. He's been diagnosed with bipolar. I said, that's none of my business. That's an outside issue, and I don't need to discuss any of that with you. I told him if he wanted to take the 12 steps and he felt like he wanted to come off the meds, then talk to his doctor and I'll work closely with him if that's what he chose to do. But I've been working with this guy for a couple of months now, and it's amazing to see the revelations happening in his life and his perception of life. So I have no opinion on that today. I just know they don't work for me. It's not my solution. And that's what I share with the guys that I sponsor. It's not my solution. My solution came out of the 12 steps, out of the book. You know, I thought I had a lot of issues with depression and anger and all that stuff. You know, and I don't have issues with any of that. You know, I suffered from untreated alcoholism. I just didn't know it. You know, it tells me in We Agnostics, it gives a list of the bedevilments. You know, that's the symptoms of untreated alcoholism. And that's what I suffered from. And it's a spiritual illness, and I know that today. You know, it's not a mental illness that can be taken care of through psychiatry or medication or anything else. Not for me, it's not. So I'm seeing this doctor, and I'm going to this doctor, and she asked me if I drink, and I'm like, yeah. She's like, how much? I said, about 3 or 4 days a week. How often 3 or 4 days a week? How much? Maybe 9 beers, 6 beers, whatever. You know, what else do you? I smoke a little weed and blah, 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 blah. So, and I also tell this doctor that, you know, our sessions, her notes may be subpoenaed to court. And trying to get the doctor on my side and manipulate her into getting my way. So the notes that she agrees to take notes, but not full in-depth notes. Just like maybe a quick summary or whatever, just in case. So I go to this doctor and I'm whining and crying and he's talking about how bad I feel and how guilty I feel for killing this guy. And he's got two kids that'll never know their dad and on and on and on, actually I'm just feeling sorry for myself because I'm going to prison, you know, and my life's over. It's ruined. I couldn't care about the guy and his family and his kids, You know, I went to trial. I got convicted of second-degree murder, and the jury gave me the minimum sentence that I could get, which was 5 years in the state of Virginia. And at that time, there was still good time in parole, so I only had to do half of it, 2.5 years. And, you know, when you're facing 20 to life and you get 2.5 years, that's a relief. And I'm sitting in the courtroom, and the jury comes back and hands down the verdict and gives me my time, and I smile. I mean, not on the outside, but I smile on the inside because I know I'm all right. They take me out in handcuffs. I turn around and look. My family, my mother's crying. She's having a nervous breakdown. My friends are crying. My girlfriend's crying. Everybody's bawling and crying. I don't understand why. I just don't understand why, you know. In my mind, I got away with murder. And I believed that for a long time. And as sick as it is, I used that experience to feed my pride and my ego for a long time. You know, I told you my definition of a man was a rough, tough, macho guy. And if you killed somebody, then you're a rough, tough, macho guy. And, you know, I walked into that penitentiary, and it was cold, it was dark. I was out in Southampton, and I knew immediately I didn't belong there. And like I said, I had no faith, no trust, and no God, but I prayed to whatever God that was out there to just get me out of there alive. Because I'm a scared little boy on the inside, but I'm not going to show you that on the outside. And so I'm in there, and I'm starting to, you know, I'm doing my time, and within a couple of months, I find my role models again. And I start making wine, I start drinking, I start getting drunk, I start selling dope, I start doing a lot of other things in the penitentiary people probably shouldn't be doing. It's a good reason, probably the reason why they go back, and reason why I went back. You know, I made it out of there, and second day after I got out, I was back with the same people doing the same thing, drinking again. And I'd come up with a plan and an idea for my life, and it was going to work, but it did not involve not drinking. And I stayed out. I got a job. I got a vehicle. Things were doing good. I got involved in a relationship with a woman much older than me. Much older than me, had 3 kids, was pretty settled, and, you know, I thought that was the answer. This will help settle me down, become a family man. And, you know, that lasted for a short period, and, you know, I was back to drinking every single night. And coming in, you know, I was living with her, and I used her, and I've used her, and, you know, she had money, and she'd buy me clothes and take me out to dinner every night and give me money to go drinking with the guys, and that was great. That was wonderful. I had no responsibility, didn't have to pay any bills, and that was great. And I was able to do whatever I wanted to do, and there was no questions asked. And needless to say, that relationship didn't last. But that ended, and I got really heavily involved in narcotics at this time. And not just the using, but the dealing, the wheeling, the dealing, the selling. And that life became exciting to me. It became powerful to me. You know, I got fired from probably the best job I had. Was advancing with this restaurant company very rapidly. I got fired from that job because I got an assault and battery charge. I was out drinking one night, and they decided they didn't want anyone drinking, you know, anyone working for them, you know, living the kind of lifestyle I was living. And at that time, I decided I was going to stop drinking. And I think I went about 20 days without drinking, and I decided it would be okay to drink again. You know, totally forgot about the reason why I wanted to stop drinking. You know, and I decided it would be okay. This time is going to be different. You know, I just won't drink liquor. I'll just drink beer. I don't get angry. I don't get in fights when I just drink beer. You know, so I just drank beer, and I got angry, and I got in a fight, and that didn't work. And so I started drinking liquor again. It was vodka, so I quit drinking vodka. It was tequila, so I quit drinking tequila. You know, and I did all the things that we do to try to control and drink and manipulate our drinking, and none of it ever worked. But I got a job. I was arrested for assault and battery. I was out on bond, waiting to go to court. So I took a job as a bouncer in a bar, and the owner of this bar gave me this job to keep me from being there all night drinking and starting fights. She thought it'd be a good way to keep me sober while I was in her establishment. And it did. You know, I drank, but I didn't drink enough to get drunk, you know, until after the bar was closed. But, you know, I told you I was into selling narcotics and stuff, and I'm standing at the front door, you know, and and that was it was a great job for me. You know, it allowed me to do what I needed to do. It placed me in a position of authority, I felt, in my head, place of power. I got to choose, you know, really who came in the bar, who didn't. I got to choose who was going to put money in my pocket to get into the bar and who didn't. And if someone happened to get in a fight, then it gave me the right to go do what I wanted to do and act the way I like to act, free of consequences, because that was my job. And, you know, I had that job until I went to court for the assault charge. I went to jail. And I went to jail that time, spent 45 days in there, and every single day, all I could think about was the day I got out. I knew exactly what I was going to do. There was no plan or idea for my life this time. The plan was to go right across the street to 7-Eleven, start drinking. Hung out with a punk rock band, local band, and they were playing the night I was getting out, and that's all I looked forward to. And my brother picked me up that Friday morning. It was Mother's Day weekend. And I have to tell you this, when I went into jail this time, I called my mom to bring me some clothes, and she said, well, I can't do it today. It'll have to be, you know, like 2 or 3 days later when she had time. And I got angry. I got very angry because she wouldn't do it right then and there. You know, you don't understand. I need them right now. You know, when you bring them up here, it takes them 2 days for them to get them to me. So I need them today. You know, and she said, no, I just can't do it. And I didn't speak to her anymore when I was locked up. I didn't speak to her for a couple months when I got out after that. But I got out Mother's Day weekend. Mother's Day was Sunday. I got out that Friday. I went to my brother picked me out where I crossed the street 7-Eleven, bought a six-pack. Went out to my dad's, packed my clothes, went back out to Virginia Beach. And I started staying with a buddy of mine out there. And it got worse. You know, the next 4 months of my drinking, a lot of things happened. I'm not very proud of today. You know, I prided myself on them before. I'm not very proud of them today. I became a monster, a menace to society. And I started experiencing blackouts very frequently. I was in a blackout one night. I got a phone call one morning. Waitress at this bar I used to hang out, same bar I used to work at. I was up there one night, and there was a band that was playing up there, and the drummer owed my brother like $500 for some damage he had done to his vehicle when they were, you know, settling out of court or whatever, and he was supposed to pay my brother, and he never did. So me and my brother and another buddy of ours went up to the bar they were playing, and I blacked out early. I mean early, like between 10 and 11 o'clock, and I don't remember nothing until later on that night, and I was kind of in and out of the blackout at that time. And what I do remember is my brother and I leaving, and I told my brother they jumped me. And I don't know where that came from, but he turned the truck around, and we went back, and he had a pipe wrench in the back of his truck, and we pulled up out in the parking lot, and the band members were out there loading their stuff, and I blacked out again. And when I came to, the owner of the bar was pulling that pipe wrench out of my hands. And I don't know what happened in between. I got a phone call the next morning from one of the waitresses up there, and she told me I beat them band members with that pipe wrench. And that scared me. You know, that scared me enough to decide I was going to quit drinking for real this time. I knew I needed to stop drinking. And I was thinking about running away. I was dating a girl that was going to ECU, and her uncle had a restaurant down there in Greensboro, North Carolina, and had a little apartment on the side of it, and she said I could go down there, she could talk to her uncle, get me a job, and I could live there. And I was seriously contemplating doing that, and I was calling the jail every day to see if there was any warrants for my arrest. And after about a third or fourth day and there was no warrants, I decided, well, if they were going to press charges, they would have already done it. So it's okay for me to drink again. And I started drinking again, and I don't know how long. I was having a lot of blackouts, and my brother and I were living in this apartment. A couple buddies of ours were crashing there, and I got in a fight with my brother one night. I was in a blackout, and I still don't remember it to this day. He told me what happened. The next day he came and packed his stuff and he left. You know, we'd already gotten an eviction notice. We had 30 days to find somewhere to live, and I think at this point I had about 2.5-3 weeks left. And, you know, at this point in my life, my parents are done. My friends are gone. Guys that I used to drink with, that drank like me and acted like me sometimes, they didn't trust me anymore. They didn't enjoy being around me anymore. And everybody was gone, so I had no money, nowhere to go. And September 16th of 2000, I'd been up for a couple of days drinking. straight. I used to set my alarm clock for like 9 or 9:30 in the morning, and when the alarm clock went off, it was time for me to stop drinking, go get cleaned up, and get ready to go to work. And I was talking to my girlfriend last night, and I was like, you know, I'm so delusional that for the first few years of my sobriety, I never thought, I told you I wasn't a morning drinker. I never went to sleep in order to wake up to have the drink in the morning. You know, the craving, the allergy, the physical craving was always satisfied throughout the hours of the night. Therefore, there was no craving. So I didn't have to wake up or have a drink. I constantly drank. You know, I'd go to work, I'd make myself a drink when I got there, I'd drink that, you know, do my job. I'd either, if the boss wasn't there, if the owner wasn't there, I could drink all day. If he was there, I knew I could drink, you know, at 2 o'clock when he left, or 1:30. And so it was no big deal. The jobs that I had, they helped me drink the way I like to drink, you know. And so September 16th, 2000, I'm out to... It's a sunny day. It's warm. Shorts on. I went down at 6 o'clock in the morning. I was at the 7-Eleven. I bought a 12-pack. 8 o'clock, I was back buying another 12-pack. 10 o'clock, a buddy of mine came by. He went over and he bought like a 30-pack or whatever. 12 o'clock, another buddy came by. He went and bought a 12-pack. And we decided to go down to this little restaurant down on the beach and have a few drinks. We went down there, had a few drinks. And a friend of mine lived across the street. So we're leaving, go across the street. We're outside talking to him. And the beer is still in the truck, so I go across the street to get the beer out of the truck. I'm crossing back across the street, and I walk out in front of this car. And it's an old man, an old woman, elderly couple, out probably after church for a Sunday drive, enjoying the weather and the day. And I walked out in front of them. The old man said a few obscenities at me, and I turned around. I took my beer bottle, and I slung it at the car. And it went into the driver's side window, and it hit him in the head and busted his head open. And the cops came. I was arrested again. For maliciously launching a missile into a moving vehicle and assault and battery. And I was already out on bond for trespassing and threatening bodily harm. And I got those charges because I went back to the establishment where the pool hall, where I'd killed the guy in the parking lot. I went back to the same establishment, and the same manager that was there at that time was still working there. And I was promptly asked to leave, and as I was leaving, the employees, the workers and stuff followed me outside, me and my friends, and... and I invited the guy to step out off the sidewalk. I told him I'd make sure I got the right one. I put him 6 feet deep this time. And he called the cops and pressed charges on me. And, I never aspired to become this type of person. You know, I did not, I wanted to control and enjoy my drinking. I really did. I wanted to go out and get drunk and have a good time. But that's not the way it happened for me. So I threw this beer bottle and hit this guy, and cops come. I get arrested again, and... they put me in the back of the cop car, and it's a breath of fresh air. You know, I go into the jail on a tree leaf. You know, I know with my record I'm going to go do some time, and that's okay. I had nowhere to go. I was being evicted. I had nowhere to go. I had no money. I had nothing. And nothing to look forward to. I'd run out of ideas for my life. And so going to jail was welcoming to me. I knew I was free of responsibility, and everything was going to be all right. So I go into this jail, and, I'm in there, and I call my mom, and... and I tell her, what's going on and stuff, and call my dad, and, they're not getting me a lawyer this time. I don't even ask them to. I don't ask them to send me money. I did ask my dad to send me money one time, and he did my taxes for me. And the refund that I got for my taxes, that's what I lived off of for the next year and a half while I was in jail. My parents, I knew they weren't going to send me no money, and I felt guilty even asking them for it. And, so I was on the phone with my mom during one conversation there this time, and I told her, I said, well, I said, I'm going to quit doing the cocaine and the meth. That's what's making me hallucinate and become really angry and violent. She said, what about drinking? And, she watched her dad and my grandfather die homeless on the streets of downtown Norfolk when I was about 9 or 10 years old of alcoholism. And, and she saw it. She knew there was nothing she could do. And, she asked me if I was ready to quit drinking, and I told her, I don't know. I said, I guess this is just how the rest of my life is going to be spent. And I didn't think about what that was going to do to her. Never crossed my mind. I never thought about the effects on my family when they used to come visit me on the weekends in the penitentiary. My mom cried every single weekend leaving that penitentiary. every single weekend, she cried on the way home, except for one. And that was the last one, because I was in the car with her. And, you know, when we hung up the phone this time, after I got out, she was picking me up from a meeting one night. She reminded me of this phone call. She told me after she hung the phone up, she cried for hours because she knew she had lost me. There was nothing she could do. And, you know, and I never understood why everyone was so upset every time I went to jail. You know, every time I got in trouble, I never understood why the effects on other people and those that love me the most. But, you know, during this time I'm in jail, they come and get me and they move me into the substance abuse program. And I didn't ask to go there. I didn't want to be there. They had rules. You had to go to sleep at night. You couldn't curse. You had to go to group. And, you know, and I'm in jail, man. They don't tell me to follow any rules. And I didn't want to be there. They put me there anyway. And a counselor came in. He didn't have any paperwork for me. He asked me who I was. I told him, he said, do you want to stay or do you want to go? And I said, well, I think I'll stay because I think I have a problem. And, you know, and I don't know, you know, I don't know where those words came from. But I spent 14 months in there, minus 3 days that I had to go to the hold. But out of those 14 months, I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got introduced to the 12 steps. The counselor I had 20-some years sober in AA. And I'm grateful for his sobriety. You know, I try not to be too judgmental of others, but I'm human. I do judge others. I wouldn't want his sobriety today. That's not the kind of sobriety I want. But his words to me sitting in there, that's what got through to me. And that's what I needed. I need someone to tell me the truth. I need someone to put it bluntly, honestly, and harshly. That's what gets through to me. And this is a pretty intimidating-looking guy. And, you know, we're sitting in a group one day, and he used to get angry and face get all red and get this evil look in his eyes, you know, and lean up in his chair. And he did that one day, and he said, work the steps or die, mother. And, you know, and that's what worked. And I believed him. And that's what sunk in. And, you know, and I, for the first time, I was able to admit I was powerless over alcohol. You know, I started to understand what it was saying in the doctor's opinion. You know, about being restless, irritable, and discontent, about having an allergy to alcohol, that when I take a drink, I have absolutely no control over the amount that I drink once I start drinking, and I don't have the power to stop drinking entirely. You know, I tried that, and it never worked. So I started to read the big book, and I started to understand it, and I was going to meetings, and, you know, the meetings they're not like AA meetings on the street. You know, you get the message from whoever brings the message in. And then sometimes it's the AA message or sometimes it's their message, you know, depending upon how they got sober. But there was one particular gentleman that used to come in there, Bill Campbell, and he would come in. He'd always give me a hug, always had a smile on his face, very soft-spoken. And he came in there on a Thursday night and he celebrated 20 years sitting beside me in that meeting. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, you know, why are you in here celebrating 20 years? Why aren't you out there, you know, at a real meeting, showing everybody that you got 20 years? And, you know, that's just where my self-centeredness and my ego is. That's what I would have been doing. Today I know this man has more humility than a lot of people I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he has way more humility than I'll probably ever have. He also married a woman and they raised 5 children together. And I'm dating a woman now that has 5. She's a single mom of 5. And it's very scary. And I seen him at a meeting. And I said, Bill, I got to tell you something. I'm dating a woman that has 5 kids. And he shook his head and patted me on the back. He said, I understand. And I said, I know you do. I said, how do you do it? He said, one day at a time. I said, thank you. But, you know, and I'm real grateful for Bill and the other guys that came in there. You know, and I spent 14 months in there. And I learned a lot about the illness of alcoholism. You know, I learned a lot about how alcohol affects me. I didn't learn a whole lot about the spiritual program of action in the book. And, you know, I got out of jail. I got a sponsor. I got a home group. I got active. And when I asked Mark to sponsor me, Mark Gilbert's my sponsor. When I asked Mark to sponsor me, he said, I got 2 rules. He said, one is you call me every day. He said, and 2 is that if you ever think you're going to take a drink, you call me before you take a drink. He said, I don't care what time it is. He said, you can call me anytime. Anytime if you need to talk. And I said, all right. And he said, you got a big book? I said, yeah. He said, start reading the doctor's opinion. He said, read it every single day for 30 days. He said, you have a dictionary? I said, no. He said, get one. You're going to need it. And he took my book and he underlined a bunch of words in the doctor's opinion. He said, now I want you to look up, when you get a dictionary, look up the definition of these words. And he said, don't just look them up as you're reading. He said, look the definition up, write it on a sheet of paper, and have that sheet of paper with you beside you as you're reading the book. He said, if you want to get sober, the answer's in here, and you have to understand what you're reading. And I did that, and I got tons of definitions written in my book on paper, and one of my home group members just gave me one of those big book dictionary things yesterday, and that's wonderful. And you know, I'm real grateful to have that today. But you know, we started going through the steps out of the book, and you know, and I'd read it, and I'd sit down with him, and we'd go over it, and he'd share his experience with it, and so I could identify, and I'd share mine, and we went through the steps that way. And he asked me if I had a higher power, and I told him yes. You know, and I believed in something. Nothing personal to me. And so when I came in here, I just used AA as a whole. I knew it worked for y'all. I saw it working for y'all. And I just believed that it would work for me. I had nothing else to believe in, you know. So I believed AA would work for me. And that was all I needed to make a beginning. And when we got to step three, and you know, I started reading step three in there, and it talked about being selfish and self-centered. And I would have told you I'm not self-centered, you know. I'm not egotistical. You know, I got low self-esteem. I'm shy. I feel less than. There's no ego there. You know, and it's the direct opposite. You know, I would have told you I did nice things for people all the time. I did, but I wanted payment for them. You know, I either wanted you to pat me on the back. I wanted a relationship. I wanted sex. I wanted money. I wanted drugs. I wanted alcohol. I wanted something from you. I had no conception of what it meant to be of service to someone else, selflessly, selfless, self-sacrifice. I had no conception of any of those words or any of those spiritual terms, as it says in the book. You know, honesty, tolerance, patience. Yeah, had none of that. So we get to step three, and you know, and basically it's a decision. You know, it's a decision. And I don't understand. I don't know what to do to turn my will in my life over. I didn't know what my will in my life was. You know, my sponsor told me your will in your life is your thoughts and your actions. You know, and at that time I was turning my thoughts and my actions over to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, whatever AA wanted me to do, whatever I was told to do, that's what I was willing to do. And it was, I made a commitment to go through with the rest of the steps. You know, the rest of the steps are the action steps. And that's where the transformation happens as I take these actions. And, you know, so we went down after my home group one night, Saturday night in Craddock. We went down to the bottom room of the church. We got on our knees. We held hands and we said the third step prayer together. You know, and I walked home from the meeting that night and I just felt the overwhelming sense of peace and serenity. I just knew everything was going to be okay. And I knew I had to complete the rest of the 12 steps because I made a commitment. I don't think I'd ever kept a commitment in my life. You know, and I made this commitment and I knew I needed to keep it. And, you know, I believe integrity to be today is to do the things I say I'm going to do, when I say I'm going to do them, be where I say I'm going to be. And if something were to happen and come up that I can't be there, to let somebody know ahead of time in advance. And, you know, so I started to learn some integrity and what it meant to make a commitment and keep a commitment. And so I did my fourth step, and, you know, I had this list of resentments and fears and sex conduct and, you know, I had a lot of things I felt remorseful over and ashamed over, and a lot, you know, some things I really didn't want to tell another human being. And I had a lot of fear of the fifth step, so I procrastinated on my fourth step for a while. And, you know, eventually I finished it, and I told my sponsor I'm done. He's like, all right, you know, we set up a time, went to his house one evening, we went out back, we ordered some pizza, and sat on his back deck, and I did my fifth step, you know. And my sponsor started off, and he shared some things with me from his past. And one of the things that he shared was very, very similar to something I had done, you know, in my past, and I felt the most shame and guilt over and remorse. And, you know, and I was able to say I did that too, and I shared that with him. And the rest was just came out, you know. I didn't feel, you know, embarrassed or humiliated by telling him these things anymore, you know. And I had a connection with another human being for the first time in my life. And I got done. I went home. I did 6 and 7, as it says in the book. Meditated for a little while over the first 5 steps, make sure, you know, I wasn't leaving anything out. I got on my knees and I said the 7-step prayer. And I have to tell you, my perception of the 7-step at that time was God was going to remove these bad things from me so I would feel better. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time to feel better. I did what you told me to do to feel better. That's what I wanted. Self-seeking. I did service, self-seeking. I sponsored, self-seeking. I went to meetings, self-seeking. I made coffee, self-seeking. It was all self-seeking. And granted, yes, I wasn't drinking, so I was feeling a little bit better. But there came a point where I wasn't feeling so good anymore. I didn't feel like the steps were working. And I'll get to that in a minute. I'm going to finish up. My perception of the seventh step was God was going to remove all these character defects. And I think I was almost 5 years sober when I learned what the seventh step prayer actually meant. And it meant that God was going to pick and choose which character defects to remove. And He was going to remove the ones that stood in the way of me carrying out His will, you know, being of service to Him and my fellows, not the ones that caused me discomfort. And the ones that caused me discomfort, those are the ones I really want gone. I don't care about the other ones. And I was sitting in a workshop, my home group, and Al Jacobson said it. You know, and the words just sunk in. And I know I'd heard it before, but the words just sunk in. And my life took a change right there. It took a turn. And partially anyway. But I went, you know, I had this list of people I needed to make amends to. I sat down with my sponsor. We went over it. There were some people on there I felt like I needed to make direct amends to. He said no. He said, you know, you've caused them enough problems in their life. Leave them the hell alone. He said if it was meant for you to make direct amends, God would provide a time and a place and you would know it. And I was like, all right. And there were some amends I didn't really want to make or think I needed to make that I had to make. Some of the best amends that I made, they've been to my family members, the ones I hurt the most. I made amends to my brother and he told me, you know, he said, you know, all that stuff. He said, there's one thing that you said to me that's really hurt me the most. And I told him one time, I had this guy I grew up with, Joel, who's my best friend. Me and my brother never got along. We've always hated each other pretty much. He's always wanted that loving, brotherly relationship, and I haven't. So I told him one time, we got in a fight, and I told him one time that Joel would be more of a brother to me than he would ever be. And I made amends with my brother. He told me when I said that to him, that scarred him the most. You know, and I told him I was wrong and asked him what I could do to make that right. He said, I just want you to, he said, I want you to keep doing what you're doing. I want you to stay sober. I want you to be happy. My brother and I, we don't have the best relationship today. We're not close. But we don't fight and argue anymore either. It is what it is. And we're okay with that. I got to make amends to my mom, my dad. I had some financial amends. And I sat on some financial amends for a very long time, for years, over 5 years. And it was $50. $50, that was it. And I'd had that money 100 times over. And it was to a restaurant that I stole some money from. And I went and heard Tom I speak up in Hampton one night. And I remember him saying he doesn't think, he doesn't feel that he will ever achieve true freedom until he has set right every single wrong he's ever done. And I've been thinking about this amends as $50, and I just don't want to part with money. And when he said that night, I was like, man, I got to pay this money. I got to make this amends. So that night, I left it. I went to that restaurant, and I paid that money. This was like from 7 or 8 years prior. And I go in, and I speak to the manager in there, or the guy that was the manager or whatever, and I tell him what I did. I said, about 7 or 8 years ago, I was in here, I was drunk, there was a stack of money sitting on this counter. I left, and I took it. It was like $46 or $47, and I handed him $50. I said, I need to repay that. And I said, if there's anything else I can do to make this right, please let me know. And he said, how much was it? And I said, I don't know, $40-some. He said, let me get your change. I said, no, don't worry about it. I don't want to change. He said, well, thank you. He said, I wish you luck in whatever you're doing. You know, I didn't have to tell him I'm a drunk trying to stay sober. I need to do that with some people, but some people I don't. I just need to make right the wrong. I love talking about the amends in my life and things that I've done. Steps 10, 11, and 12 I practice on a daily basis. Step 10 is awareness for me. It's awareness of my character defects and when I'm acting out of them. It's awareness of the way I think and how selfish and self-centered it is. And then it gives me directions on how to get out of that, things to do. Make amends if I have to. Turn my thoughts to somebody I can be of service to help. I go through the day. My head's not in the clouds with God all day. Trust me. My head is with me all day. And that's dangerous. But one of the things I can say is regardless of how I think all day, pretty much, if I'm asked to do something for somebody, I do it. Anytime I'm asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, I do it, unless I absolutely cannot do it. I have no problem helping people out today. I have moved more people since I got sober than I've ever moved in my life. And I can't, I hate it. But I can't say no, you know? And I have to do it without charging them. That's what really sucks. That's like work. But in step 11 is improving my conscious contact with the God of my understanding. And I do that through prayer, meditation, and inventory today. You know, I get up in the morning at least a half hour before I got to go to work and sit down. I have my coffee. I read the daily reflection. I might pick up the big book and read something. I might not. And I just sit back and I just listen, you know. And a lot of times listening in my head drives me nuts. But I've learned not to try to control it today. You know, I just let it go wherever it's going to go. You know, anytime I try to control it, I'm fighting it. I cannot control the way that I think, no matter what. I've tried that, and it just drives me even more crazy. So I do that, and for the most part, my days are pretty good. You know, I get restless, irritable, and discontent just like anybody else. Work's the hardest place for me to practice these principles. I'm going through a lot of issues with work right now, some things that are happening there. Step 12, carrying the message. I sponsor a lot of guys. I have sponsored a lot of guys. I do a lot of service work in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I try to be the best example I can be. You know, it tells me in the book to walk hand in hand with the new guy. And I don't necessarily walk hand in hand every day with the new guy, but I walk hand in hand with the new guy to the best of my ability. I got a phone call a few months ago, it was like 3 in the morning. One of my old guys, a sponsor, he took drunk. He'd been drinking for a while. His mother called me at 3 in the morning. She didn't know what to do with him. She had got a call to come pick him up because he was too drunk to drive. And she called me, and I asked her to take him. I said, take him to the detox. I'll meet you there. So I met her down at the detox. It was around 4. They didn't have any open beds. She was crying. She didn't want to take him home. She couldn't take it. So I took him back with me, stopped and got something to eat, took him to my house. Slept on the couch. We got up the next day. I went into work. I told him I needed the day off. I needed to take some emergency vacation time. I took that day off, and that was on a Thursday. I took Thursday and Friday off. And I hung out with him that day. I took him home. He got cleaned up. I took him to his job so we can talk to his boss, let his boss know he needs a few days off. I told him to be honest with him, let him know what's going on with you. And he did that. And we went to a meeting that night, and I stayed at his house that night. I didn't think he needed to be alone. And the next day we got up and went to a meeting. And I went home and he went home and he had some things to do. And we were going to go to Richmond. We were going to meet at the Jaywalkers meeting in Richmond that evening. He called me about 4:30, 5 o'clock. He said he needed to go see his lawyer and he wasn't going to be able to make it. And I said, okay. And so I'm going to call one of my other sponsees and set up, you know, to meet with him to go to a meeting. He's like, all right, I will. You know, he didn't. And I haven't heard from him since. And that's none of my business. You know, it's none of my business what he does. I was just taught to be there, regardless. And that's all I can do. And it's heartbreaking. You know, when he relapsed the first time, it was heartbreaking. You know, I had a lot of hope for this guy. He was doing really well with doing the steps. We did the third step, and that was it. He was done. You know. Some of the men had a wonderful experience a few months back. And I know Tom and I got to make a direct amends to the families of the two people he killed. And I called Tom and I asked him what I needed to do for these amends. And he said, I don't like adding any words to the steps. He said, but I added one word in step 8. He said, not only do I pray for the willingness, but I pray for the opportunity. So he said, pray for the opportunity. And he said, you know, if it's God's will, it'll happen. And if it's not, it won't. Don't worry about it. You've done your part. And he asked me if I took meetings into the jail. I told him, no, I couldn't get security clearance. And I couldn't. And a few months ago, my friend Linda called me, and she asked me to go into Hampton Jail. And I said, absolutely. And she talked to the head of the department there that she needed to talk to, and she told her my story, and the lady said, I'll do whatever I can to get him security clearance. And I took my first meeting in there Monday. The gratitude that I have for corrections. And I don't understand why people don't want to take meetings into facilities. If I go in there for 10 years, and I see one guy get out and stay sober, it's 10 years worth it, because it's a life saved. And I had an opportunity this past summer. I met this woman 2 years ago. As I went to a new meeting, I've never been there before, and this woman was there. She had just got back from over in Scotland, and she was headed to Scotland. She just got back from the international conference, and on the ride home, she got a phone call, and her father had been murdered, and she shared about it in that meeting, and I was able to share my experience with that from being on the other side, and we became really good friends, and she's a dear friend of me today. And a few months ago, I had an idea. I was at work, and I had an idea. And I thought, maybe I can set her free just a little bit if I talk to her, and ask her to share her story with me and what happened. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and I talked to her sponsor about it, and they both thought it would be a good idea. So I talked to her about it and asked her if she wanted to do it. She said yes. And we met for coffee one night, and we sat for about 3 hours. And she shared her experience with me, and I shared mine with her. And this woman expressed nothing but compassion and understanding for me and for the man that killed her dad. And she wants to go visit him. He's in prison over in Scotland. It's where she's from. And she wants to go see him. She's just not quite sure she's ready. But she knows what she wants to say to him, and it's nothing angry. It's nothing out of hatred or anger. And she wants to let him know that she has forgiven him and God has forgiven him. And I believe God has forgiven me. And I don't have to carry any guilt or remorse around anymore for that. And I'll tell you, and this happened some 12 years ago or something like that. And I didn't really feel any guilt about it until this past summer. I was at the Virginia State Convention, and Tom Burns shared, and his daughter, he was 20-some years sober, and his daughter was murdered. She had 3 years of sobriety, and his daughter was murdered, and he went insane. His son and his wife had to have him committed. And I sat there, and I listened to him share his experience from the podium of the anger and the insanity that set him into. And he said the only reason why he didn't pick up the drink is because his daughter loved and cherished his sobriety. And he knew he needed to stay sober for her. But everything else was gone. He'd get up and walk in the kitchen, and his wife would come in, and he couldn't even remember her name. He forgot why he was in there. And his son had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, and his son walked him through day by day, and took care of the family business that they were in until he was able to get on his feet and do it again. And I'd never heard anyone share the pain, that sort of pain from that kind of loss. I'd never heard anyone share it like he did. And that day it hit me, and it affected me in a way it's never affected me before. And I felt guilty, and I felt bad for what I'd done. And I went to him after he spoke, and I just went to him and shook his hand, and all I could get out was that I murdered somebody. And he gave me a hug, and he said, he said, God forgives you, and I forgive you too. And I was just bawling and crying. I couldn't say nothing else. So I met with this woman, and we shared our experience with each other, and I told her, I said, if there's anything I can do in my life to make your life better, please allow me to do it. And she said, I'm celebrating 8 years at my home group this week. I'd like for you to be there. And I said, absolutely. And I was able to be there with her. My life today is full. My life today is busy. I work full-time. I just started back. I'm going to school now. I'm taking welding classes. I go to school 3 nights a week. I have 3 sponsees at the present moment, a couple service positions, commitments in AA, two at the district level, and one, I'm on the Virginia State Conference for Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous Advisory Committee, and I'm the workshop coordinator for my district, and I'm very active with workshops. I love them. I love putting them on. I love being there. I love what I learn. I love meeting people, and I go to 3 meetings a week now. I like to go to more. I just can't. I have great relationships with my mom, my dad, my sister, my niece, my brother. My sister had a baby, and I was able to be there. I'm able to be an uncle today. my life is great, and it's not by anything that I've done. Anything, by all means, feels left up to me. My ideas and my plans for my life is just to get drunk, and that's it. And thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, and the guy that my understanding that I've found here, you know, my life has unfolded into what it is today. And I'm really grateful to be here. I want to thank Billy for asking me to be here, and thank all of y'all for coming out in the weather and sharing this with me. Thank you.